listening to WXRW LP Milwaukee, River West Radio 104.1 FM, and riverwestradio.com globally. I'm your host, NTSC, and welcome to The Anti, a weekly primer on freedom. The Anti is anti-authoritarian, anti-capitalist, anti-hierarchy, anti-sexist, anti-racist, anti-fascist, and more. If we're against so much, what do we stand for? The ideals of freedom. In this series, we explore what a free society might look like while recognizing the fact that none of us today are truly free. Having said all that, even though the device on which you're listening right now likely was not free, the radio waves to which you are listening are. However, WXRW costs money to operate. To that end, you can always visit the station at 824 East Center Street, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and purchase a hat, a mug, or a t-shirt, and all proceeds will go directly to supporting the station. Or if you particularly like any of the programming you listen to on WXRW, reach out and become an official underwriter. Every little bit helps. And now you can also dial into River West Radio on your smart speaker of choice. Just tell your listening device at home to play WXRW River West Radio. We're on 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Last week we began reading the first chapter of Pyotr Kropotkin's The Conquest of Bread. One of my favorite books, one of the books that kind of got me into anarchism in general and gave me kind of a better understanding of what freedom really is and how a society based around the principles of mutual aid, free association, and solidarity might actually work, and in at least in my opinion, how much better it would be for not just all the people practicing such a system of societal organization, but also for the planet as a whole. The book is very old. Again, it was written in 1892, or at least that's when it was published. It was probably written over the series of years preceding that. So because it's, you know, even before World War I, the book is not by any means perfect. But again, I really like the text because it draws attention to how anarchism is not an ideology, it's a process. It's an organic living process, just like you know, the chemistry of your body, or the nuclear fire of our sun, that kind of thing. You know, it gets me really jazzed. And honestly, we're dealing with a lot of stuff in the world right now. And I felt I could personally use a little bit more goodness from The Conquest of Bread. So we're just going to pick up where we left off last week on the chapter 2 titled Well-Being for All. Well-being for all is not a dream. It is possible, realizable, owing to all that our ancestors have done to increase our powers of production. We know, indeed, that the producers, although they constitute hardly one-third of the inhabitants of civilized countries, even now produce such quantities of goods that a certain degree of comfort could be brought to every hearth. We know further that if all those who squander today the fruits of others' toil were forced to employ their leisure in useful work, our wealth would increase in proportion to the number of producers and more. Finally, we know that contrary to the theory enunciated by Malthus, that oracle of middle-class economics, the productive powers of the human race increase at a much more rapid ratio than its powers of production. The more thickly men are crowded on the soil, the more rapid is the growth of their wealth-creating power. Thus, although the population of England has only increased from 1844 to 1890 by 62%, its production has grown even at the lowest estimate at double that rate, to wit, by 130%. In France, where the population has grown more slowly, the increase in production is nevertheless very rapid. Notwithstanding the crises through which agriculture is frequently passing, notwithstanding state interference, the blood tax, conscription, and speculative commerce and finance, the production of wheat in France has increased fourfold, and industrial production more than tenfold in the course of the last 80 years. In the United States, the progress is still more striking. In spite of immigration, or rather precisely because of the influx of surplus European labor, the United States have multiplied their wealth tenfold. However, these figures give but a very faint idea of what our wealth might become under better conditions. For alongside of the rapid development of our wealth-producing powers, we have an overwhelming increase in the ranks of the idlers and middlemen. Instead of capital gradually concentrating itself in a few hands so that it would only be necessary for the community to dispossess a few millionaires and enter upon its lawful heritage, instead of this socialist forecast proving true, the exact reverse is coming to pass. The swarm of parasites is ever increasing. And I want to take a quick break here, just a little pause. So when Kropotkin is referring to a parasite, he's referring to the millionaires. He's referring to the industrialists and the capitalists and the monopolists. Those are the parasites that are consuming the goods created by the labor of the actual productive class, the working class. When you look at an author like Ayn Rand, when she refers to the parasites, she refers to the 99%. She thinks that the industrialists and the monopolists and the capitalists are actually the producers. And I find that to be extremely laughable. But anyway, just in case anybody was listening to this with a libertarian ear, parasite in this case means our millionaires. Or, fast forwarding to 2018, our billionaires, of whom there are about 2,000 or so in the world today. Continuing on. In France, there are not 10 actual producers to every 30 inhabitants. The whole agricultural wealth of the country is the work of less than 7 million men. And in the two great industries, mining and the textile trades, you will find that the workers number less than 2.5 million. But the exploiters of labor, how many are they? In the United Kingdom, a little over 1 million workers, men, women, and children, are employed in all the textile trades. Less than 900,000 work the mines, much less than 2 million till the ground, and it appeared from the last industrial census that only a little over 4 million men, women, and children were employed in all of the industries. So that statisticians had to exaggerate all the figures in order to establish a maximum of 8 million producers to 45 million inhabitants. Strictly speaking, the creators of the goods exported from Britain to all the ends of the earth comprise only from 6 to 7 million workers. And what is the number of the shareholders and middlemen who levy the first fruits of labor from far and near and heap up unearned gains by thrusting themselves between the producer and the consumer? Nor is this all. The owners of capital constantly reduce the output by restraining production. We need not speak of the cartloads of oysters thrown into the sea to prevent a dainty hitherto reserved for the rich from becoming a food for the people. We need not speak of the thousand and one luxuries, stuffs, food, etc., etc., treated after the same fashion as the oysters. It is enough to remember the way in which the production of the most necessary things is limited. Legions of miners are ready and willing to dig out coal every day and send it to those who are shivering with cold. But too often a third or even one half of their number are forbidden to work more than 3 days a week because, forsooth, the price of coal must be kept up. Thousands of weavers are forbidden to work the looms, although their wives and children go in rags and although three quarters of the population of Europe have no clothing worthy the name. Hundreds of blast furnaces. Thousands of factories periodically stand idle. Others only work half-time. And in every civilized nation, there is a permanent population of about 2 million individuals who ask only for work, but to whom work is denied. So I'll take another quick pause here. You'll see there's a difference between his industrialized world and that of our 2018. This pausing of creation of production to keep the cost of things high and unachievable for workers who were producing this stuff was pretty commonplace. And that kind of practice in today's kind of supply chain would be ridiculous. Today, kind of the cost of things is inflated by just pushing down the cost of production itself. So obviously everything is, if possible, created in countries that have, you know, very little in the way of labor laws, certainly very little in the way of, you know, labor protections and wage protections. That's why so many things are made in China, so many things are made in Taiwan, and we all just kind of accept it, because if it were to be made in a country like America, then we say, oh, it would cost too much, because it would cost too much to make, and therefore it would cost too much to consume. So that's just one of the differences between Kropotkin's, you know, late 1800s and our, early 20th century. We continue. How gladly would these millions of men set to work to reclaim wastelands or to transform ill-cultivated land into fertile fields, rich in harvests. A year of well-directed toil would suffice to multiply fivefold the produce of those millions of acres in this country which lie idle now as permanent pasture, or of those dry lands in the south of France which now yield only about 8 bushels of wheat per acre. But men, who would be happy to become hardy pioneers in so many branches of wealth-producing activity, must remain idle because the owners of the soil, the mines, and the factories prefer to invest their capital taken in the first place from the community in Turkish or Egyptian bonds, or in Patagonian gold mines, and so make Egyptian fellahs, Italian immigrants, and Chinese their wage slaves. This is the direct and deliberate limitation of production, but there is also a limitation indirect and not of set purpose, which consists in spending human toil on objects absolutely useless, or destined only to satisfy the dull vanity of the rich. It is impossible to reckon in figures the extent to which wealth is restricted indirectly, the extent to which energy is squandered while it might have served to produce and, above all, to prepare the machinery necessary to production. It is enough to cite the immense sums spent by Europe in armaments for the sole purpose of acquiring control of the markets and so forcing her own goods on neighboring territories and making exploitation easier at home. The millions paid every year to officials of all sorts whose function is to maintain the rights of minorities, the right that is of a few rich men to manipulate the economic activities of the nation. The millions spent on judges, prisons, policemen, and all the paraphernalia of so-called justice, spent to no purpose, because we know that every alleviation, however slight, of the wretchedness of our great cities is always followed by a considerable diminution of crime. Lastly, the millions spent on propagating pernicious doctrines by means of the press and news cooked in the interest of this or that party, of this politician, or of that group of speculators. That's certainly something that hasn't changed from 1892 to today. All the newspapers at the time were, of course, owned and operated by, well, millionaires. And obviously it's that agenda that's going to get pushed, you know, the status quo. But over and above this, we must take into account all the labor that goes to sheer waste. Here, in keeping up the stables, the kennels, and the retinue of the rich. There, in pandering to the caprices of society and the depraved tastes of the fashionable mob. There again, in forcing the consumer to buy what he does not need, or foisting an inferior article upon him by means of puffery. And in producing, on the other hand, wares which are absolutely injurious, but profitable to the manufacturer. What is squandering in this manner would be enough to double the production of useful things, or to plenish our mills and factories with machinery that they would soon flood the shops with all that is now lacking to 2/3 of the nation. Under our present system, a full quarter of the producers in every nation are forced to idle for 3 or 4 months in the year, and the labor of another quarter, if not of the half, has no better results than the amusement of the rich or the exploitation of the public. If you're just tuning in, You are listening to The Anti here on WXRW River West Radio, and I'm your host, NTSC. We're reading from Chapter 2 of Pyotr Kropotkin's The Conquest of Bread. This chapter is called Well-Being for All, and so shall this episode be called. We continue. Thus, if we consider on the one hand the rapidity with which civilized nations augment their powers of production, and on the other hand the limits set to that production, be it directly or indirectly by existing conditions, we cannot but conclude that an economic system, a trifle more reasonable, would permit them to heap up in a few years so many useful products that they would be constrained to say, "Enough! We have enough coal and bread and raiment. Let us rest and consider how best to use our powers, how best to employ our leisure." No, plenty for all is not a dream. Though it was a dream indeed in those days when man, for all his pains, could hardly win a few bushels of wheat from an acre of land, and had to fashion by hand all the implements he used in agriculture and industry. Now it is no longer a dream, because man has invented a motor which, with a little iron and a few sacks of coal, gives him the mastery of a creature strong and docile as a horse and capable of setting the most complicated machinery in motion. But if plenty for all is to become a reality, this immense capital, cities, houses, pastures, arable lands, factories, highways, education, must cease to be regarded as private property for the monopolist to dispose at his pleasure. This rich endowment, painfully won, builded, fashioned, or invented by our ancestors, must become common property, so that the collective interests of men may gain from its greatest good for all. There must be expropriation, the well-being of all, the end. Expropriation, the means. Part 2. Expropriation then, or expropriation, such then is the problem which history has put before the men of the 20th century, the return to communism in all that ministers to the well-being of man. But this problem cannot be solved by means of legislation. No one imagines that. The poor as well as the rich understand that neither the existing governments, nor any which might arise out of possible political changes, would be capable of finding such a solution. They feel the necessity of a social revolution, and both rich and poor recognize that this revolution is imminent, that it may break out in a few years. Let's take a pause there. I don't believe in ghosts, and you know, the concept of an afterlife, though it might be soothing, isn't one that I hold. But I'll kind of speak generally to the memory of Pyotr Kropotkin and say, sorry. I'm so sorry that your revolution didn't happen when you were alive. And I'm yet sorrier that it probably won't happen in my lifetime. We continue. A great change in thought has taken place during the last half of the 19th century, but suppressed as it was by the propertied classes, and denied its natural development, this new spirit must now break its bonds by violence and realize itself in a revolution. Whence will the revolution come? How will it announce its coming? No one can answer these questions. The future is hidden. But those who watch and think do not misinterpret the signs. Workers and exploiters, revolutionists and conservatives, thinkers and men of action, all feel that a revolution is at our doors. Well then, what are we going to do when a thunderbolt has fallen? We've all been bent on studying the dramatic side of revolutions so much, and the practical work of revolutions so little, that we are apt to see only the stage effects, so to speak, of these great movements. The fight of the first days, the barricades. But this fight, this first skirmish, is soon ended, and it is only after the breakdown of the old system that the real work of revolution can be said to begin. Effete and powerless, attacked on all sides, the old rulers are soon swept away by the breath of insurrection. In a few days, the middle-class monarchy of 1848 was no more, and while Louis-Philippe was making good his escape in a cab, Paris had already forgotten her citizen king. The government of Thiers disappeared, and on the 18th of March, 1871, in a few hours, leaving Paris mistress of her destinies, Yet 1848 and 1871 were only insurrections. Before a popular revolution, the masters of the old order disappear with a surprising rapidity. Its upholders fly the country to plot in safety elsewhere and to devise measures for their return. The former government having disappeared, the army, hesitating before the tide of popular opinion, no longer obeys its commanders, who have also prudently decamped. The troops stand by without interfering or join the rebels. The police, standing at ease, are uncertain whether to belabor the crowd or to cry, "Long live the commune," while some retire to their quarters to wait the pleasure of the new government. Wealthy citizens pack their trunks and betake themselves to places of safety. The people remain. This is how a revolution is ushered in. In several large towns, the commune is proclaimed. In the streets wander scores of thousands of men, and in the evening they crowd into improvised clubs, asking, "What shall we do?" and ardently discuss public affairs. All take an interest in them. Those who yesterday were quite indifferent are perhaps the most zealous. Everywhere there is plenty of goodwill and a keen desire to make victory certain. It is a time when acts of supreme devotion are occurring. The masses of the people are full of the desire of going forward. All this is splendid, sublime, but still it is not a revolution. Nay, it is only now that the work of the revolutionist begins. Doubtless there will be acts of vengeance. The Watrins and the Thomases will pay the penalty of their unpopularity, but these are mere incidents of the struggle, not the revolution. Socialist politicians, radicals, neglected geniuses of journalism, stump orators, both middle-class people and workmen, will hurry to the town hall, to the government offices, to take possession of the vacant seats. Some will decorate themselves with gold and silver lace to their heart's content, admire themselves in ministerial mirrors, and study to give orders with an air of importance appropriate to their new position. How could they impress their comrades of the office or the workshop without having a red sash, an embroidered cap, and magisterial gestures? Others will bury themselves in official papers, trying with the best of wills to make head or tail of them. They will indict laws and issue high-flown worded decrees that nobody will take the trouble to carry out, because revolution has come. To give themselves an authority which they have not, they will seek the sanction of old forms of government. They will take the names of provisional government, committee of public safety, mayor, governor of the town hall, commissioner of public safety, and whatnot. Elected or acclaimed, they will assemble in boards or in communal councils where men of 20 or 20 different schools, of 10 or 20 different schools will come together, representing not as many private chapels, as it is often said, but as many different conceptions regarding the scope, the bearing, and the goal of the revolution. Possibilists, collectivists, radicals, Jacobins, Blanquists will be thrust together and waste time in wordy warfare. Honest men will be huddled together with the ambitious ones, whose only dream is power, and who spurn the crowd whence they are sprung. All coming together with diametrically opposed views, all forced to enter into ephemeral alliances in order to create majorities that can but last a day. Wrangling, calling each other reactionaries, authoritarians, and rascals, incapable of coming to an understanding or any serious measure, dragged into discussions about trifles, producing nothing better than bombastic proclamations, all giving themselves an awful importance, while the real strength of the movement is in the streets. All this may please those who like the stage, but it is not revolution. Nothing has been accomplished as yet. And meanwhile, the people suffer. The factories are idle. The workshops closed. Trade is at a standstill. The worker does not even earn the meager wage which was his before. Food goes up in price. With the heroic devotion which has always characterized them, and which in great crises reaches the sublime, the people will wait patiently. "We place these 3 months of want at the service of the Republic," they said in 1848. While their representatives and the gentlemen of the new government, down to the meanest jack in office, received their salary regularly. The people suffer. With the childlike faith, with the good humor of the masses who believe in their leaders, they think that yonder, in the House, in the Town Hall, in the Committee of Public Safety, their welfare is being considered. But yonder, they're discussing everything under the sun except the welfare of the people. In 1793, while famine ravaged France and crippled the revolution, whilst the people were reduced to the depths of misery, although the Champs-Élysées were lined with luxurious carriages where women displayed their jewels and splendor, Robespierre was urging the Jacobins to discuss his treatise on the English Constitution. While the worker was suffering in 1848 from the general stoppage of trade, the provisional government and the National Assembly were wrangling over military pensions and prison labor without troubling how the people managed to live during the terrible crisis. And could one cast a reproach at the Paris Commune, which was born beneath the Prussian cannon and lasted only 70 days, it would be for this same error. This failure to understand that the revolution could not triumph unless those who fought on its side were fed, that on 15 pence a day a man cannot fight on the ramparts and at the same time support a family. The people suffer and say, how is a way out of these difficulties to be found? We'll stop there because we're about to enter part 3 of chapter 2. The book is really fascinating. Again, you know, written by a man of his era, and a man who came from largesse. Pyotr Kropotkin himself was a prince. He was born to a very wealthy Russian family. He was very well educated, and he never really personally understood what want and hunger was or were. Until much later in his life, when he would eventually be, deemed a traitor, obviously, for all of his anarchist activities, and he would be exiled. He would return eventually during the Russian Revolution, but we can get into his life later if we want to. Really, it's not that interesting to me, the life of the man. Something I try to guard against is hero worship. I think that the work, you know, I think that the book at least really speaks to me, and the person that wrote it is less important. I think that's why a lot of the anarchist writing that's being done, in the contemporary, I really like a lot better, because so much of it is communally written, and most, if not all of it, that I really appreciate is all anonymous. It's not attributed to any one person or any one group even, although sometimes it is. Thank you so much for listening to the continued reading of Pyotr Kropotkin's The Conquest of Bread. We might just continue going through this because with these difficult days, rereading it always kind of lifts my spirits a little bit. You know, talk of the revolution, talk of how do we take care of each other, all these lofty goals, which are very, very achievable today. The world produces so much food and goods, and there is so much available to everybody that there is no reason everybody in the world should not be fed, housed, and clothed, and cared for. That's ridiculous, but we can talk more about that next week in the weeks to come. Thank you so much for listening to The Anti here on WXRW River West Radio. I will be back again next week to discuss further topics as they relate to freedom and our awesome shared potential. Past episodes can be found at creamcitymedia.com/anti, and more information about the show can be found on riverwestradio.com. Until we meet again, thank you very much.